Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Welcome back to The Brian Lehrer Show. I'm Christina Greer, filling in for Brian today. I want to talk a little bit more about Donald Trump's comments yesterday about monuments. Let's listen.
George Washington was a slave owner. Was George Washington a slave owner? So will George Washington now lose his status? Are we going to take down, are we going to take down statues to George Washington? How about Thomas Jefferson? What do you think of Thomas Jefferson? You like him? Okay, good. Are we going to take down the statue? Because he was a major slave owner. Now, are we going to take down his statue? So you know what? It's fine. You're changing history. You're changing culture. And you had people, and I'm not talking about the neo-Nazis and the white nationalists, because they should be condemned totally. But you had many people in that group other than neo-Nazis and white nationalists, okay? And the press has treated them absolutely unfairly.
Welcome back. Okay, so there's a lot in there. Donald Trump not only tried to draw a parallel between statues of Robert E. Lee and the statue of Thomas Jefferson, he also said that not everyone carrying a torch in Charlottesville was a member of the so-called alt-right. Joining me now is Kai Wright. He's the editor and host of WNYC's United States of Anxiety podcast, which investigated not only the roots of the so-called alt-right, but of segregationist roots prevalent in American culture. Hi, Kai.
Hello.
So, Kai, let's just get right to it. Is there something to this idea? We know last night the city of Baltimore removed all of its Confederate monuments, and that was by order of the mayor and the city council, who voted for removal on Monday. Is it fair to compare Thomas Jefferson and George Washington to Robert E. Lee or Stonewall Jackson?
Well, it's two things. One, obviously not. James Fallows was saying in the previous segment, there are categorical differences between someone who mounted an army against the United States and people who worked to build the United States. That said, I listened to the president's press conference and I was indeed shocked. I know people say that you're not supposed to still be shocked by Donald Trump. I am still shocked by Donald Trump, and I found that press conference shocking. But then once I kind of got over my shock, I'm brought to the point where I'm saying, okay, this is in fact the conversation we have to have. I have spent my whole journalism career urging us to have a more intelligent and textured conversation about race and our history. And we do need to talk about, what do we think about George Washington, Thomas Jefferson? How are they different from Robert E. Lee? And hey, he's forcing us into that conversation now. It's, there is a graphic that's been circulating on social media that is making me very happy. And it's the Southern Poverty Law Center has this graphic they made of the times when all of these statues, all these Confederate memorials were built, right? And so, they've charted each one, as many as they could chart, across time. And if you look at it, you see, of course, that they were all built a huge number of them were built between 1896, Plessy v. Ferguson, that said segregation is in fact legal in the United States, and the 1919 race riots, the summer in which there was mass marauding in the streets and killing of black people. And in that period, that's an important period in our American history that most people just don't think about and don't know about. And that's when these monuments were built. All of a sudden, we're having a conversation about that. How is that period different from the founding of our country, when we did in fact have slaveholders wrestling with how to square the ideals of freedom and equality that they were writing down to build this country with the reality of this country of holding slaves? So all of a sudden, there's this popular conversation about what is the difference between a Jefferson and a Robert E. Lee? What is the difference between these Confederate statues and the likes, the things we like to say about founding fathers? So I kind of welcome this. I feel like that he as shocking as it is, Donald Trump is doing us a service right now.
Because this is not a conversation we had necessarily under the 8 years of Barack Obama. I think quite a few people took a victory lap for years without having to do the hard digging to really excavate the foundation.
That's right.
So, listeners, we need you to do a bit of citizen reporting for us today. I think a lot of people here in New York can be quick to look at what's happened in Charlottesville and say, well, that's the South. That has nothing to do with me. But of course, that is not really true. I keep thinking about something Malcolm X famously said, that anything south of the Canadian border is the American South.
Indeed.
So today I want to talk about the problematic things that we do have here in New York City, and I need your help. So I want to open up the phone lines for all of you who see problematic landmarks, monuments, place names, icons, or even graffiti in your community, which I found yesterday on my MTA subway ride. Maybe it's something you've been passing for a long time, and now that you're seeing it with fresh eyes because of what's been going on in the news from the past week or maybe even the past few months, maybe it's something you've always thought was problematic. Tell us what you see and when you became aware of it. Our number is 212-433-WNYC. That's 212-433-9692. Or if you have a picture, you can tweet it to us at Brian Lehrer. So for those of us just joining us, I'm Christina Graham, filling in for Brian Lehrer, and I'm talking to Kai Wright. So Kai, so while we're waiting for these calls, let's get to the second part of what Donald Trump said in that clip, that not everyone carrying a torch in Charlottesville was a member of the so-called alt-right. What did he mean by that? And what have you come across in your reporting that leads you to believe that that statement's either true or not true?
I can't tell you what he meant specifically about by that, but I will say this. You know, when he tried to make this sort of equivocation of there's a such thing as the alt-right and there's a such thing as the alt-left, that was probably the most troubling part of those statements to me, because it's part of his work in erasing what the alt-right actually represents. And we should be clear about it. Mm-hmm. You know, the alt-right is a term that it didn't come from the media. It didn't come from liberals or progressives. It is credited to Richard Spencer, who is an avowed neo-Nazi and white nationalist, and who helped organize the Charlottesville protest. Mm-hmm. And he said, following George Bush's administration, that mainstream conservatism did not represent him. And so he created an alternative right to bring together the disparate forces of people who believed in white identity, ranging from a particular corner of libertarians to a certain type of sort of aggrieved white maleness called the manosphere, to neo-Nazis, and brought them together under the umbrella of the alt-right. And there are two things that Spencer himself says gelled that movement. One was Breitbart.com, which was rebooted by Steve Bannon, who is mm-hmm. currently in the White House as a chief strategist and was a chief strategist on Trump's campaign. And he, in his own words, specifically targeted this group of people that Richard Spencer, an avowed neo-Nazi, dubbed the alt-right, in order to build that website around. Secondly, they then built a campaign around them. And that person, and Steve Bannon, remains in the White House. So it is very important that we remember that history, that the alt-right thing, it came from white nationalists themselves. That's how they named themselves. And so if you are someone who has associated yourself with that movement, whether or not you're a chief strategist in the White House or you're a person who's showing up at a march, you have to presume that you have co-signed with the idea of white nationalism.
So that essentially answers my next question. Can you show up to a protest, the statue of Robert E. Lee coming down, and not be a racist or a neo-Nazi?
It's very easy to talk about these things in abstract terms, but if you spend time, as I have, in these corners of the internet where this organizing goes on, and on these websites, in these 4chan boards, it is unambiguous. It is unambiguous, the conversation that they're having. It is, and I have to say, in addition to being racist and anti-Semitic, it is strikingly misogynist. I mean, probably the thing you walk away with the most is just the vile hatred of women and the violence against women that they're prepared to discuss. I mean, one of the reactions on the Daily Stormer, which I believe has now been taken down finally by GoDaddy that hosted it, avowed neo-Nazi website, they reacted to Heather Meyer's death by calling her fat and ugly. I'm not going to repeat the things, but in these really violent gendered attacks on this dead woman. Mm-hmm. And so if you're in that space, and that's how this rally was organized, was through those spaces. So if you're in that space, if you're actually in there, it is very difficult to imagine that you would be like, oh, well, you know, this is about Southern history. It's not really that, you know, I don't agree with those other things. It's very hard to imagine that you could be in those spaces and not co-sign these views.
In case you're just joining us, I'm Christina Griffilian for Brian Lehrer, and I'm with Kai Wright, WNYC's United States of Anxiety podcast host. So can you explain to someone then who might not understand why this statue and all of these Confederate statues need to come down?
Well, so that's why I'm happy. I mentioned earlier this Southern Poverty Law Center graphic mm-hmm. that's circulating, because suddenly I have for years heard the debate, you know, well, you know, is it history? We can't whitewash the history. the term whitewash. But we can't ignore the history. These things are important. What we are having as a consequence of Charlottesville now is an education about what these things actually are. And they were built beginning in 1896, but the bulk of them coming in that period in 1896, coming out of Reconstruction, when the South was reasserting, when the Confederacy was reasserting itself in its control over the South and saying, okay, we have had emancipation of slaves, I understand that, but we are not going to change the power structure in the South. And so in order to do that, in order to reassert that power structure, we're going to do a couple of things. One, we are going to rewrite Southern history, and we're going to say that we weren't the people who were defeated in a war. We are people who are proud and who are gallant and who are protectors of white purity, which is what America is supposed to be. And so we're going to celebrate that as aggressively as we can, and mm-hmm. we're going to build memorials to that idea to re-up the Confederacy. And alongside that, we are going to launch a campaign of terrorism. We are going to systematically lynch people, in some places conduct actual ethnic cleansing and drive black people totally out of the towns. That era of lynching, of anti-black terrorism that swept across the South, and really in the North as well, but really particularly across the South in that period between 1896 and really the 30s, that coincided with the erection of these statues. They need to be understood as operating hand in hand. Mm-hmm. So they are statements of war against black people. They are statements of violence against black people. And now, as a consequence, and most people don't know that history because we are so ahistorical.
As a nation.
Mm-hmm. You know, most people, black and white alike, we don't know that history. And that these monuments represent something, and they represent this statement of violence. And so now, as a consequence of this debate, we're finally starting to have more widespread understanding of that history. And that's why they have to come down.
Well, you know, yesterday the New York Post reported that there's a plaque honoring General Lee on a tree outside of a church in Brooklyn. And this week, the diocese officials said that it would be removed. So let's take some callers. So we're going to go to Daoud from Portchester, New York. Hi, Daoud. Welcome to WNYC.
Yes. Good morning. Peace to the world. First of all, I was calling related to the Christopher Columbus statue that's at Columbus Circle. Mm-hmm. And one of the things, you know, I'm a 60-year-old man here, African-American, actually Muslim, by the way, too. Growing up in America, it was so different. And because at that time, you know, things were opening up. My parents used to live in Alabama and Georgia, so they very much had to deal with things in the South, and they left because of what was going on there. But the problem I face, I think, is that we don't get below the surface of the history of the United States until well into going to universities. And that's when we really start to learn what was behind things, because we don't look at the original documents. But I think people like Donald Trump and other people who are in our power structure, they've missed an opportunity the last couple of generations, because things are going so much in the right direction, where America used to be such a beautiful place to live. And unfortunately, we're going in the wrong direction. But I'm excited about the fact that people are really talking about this thing. I think it's good that he said what he said yesterday. Unfortunately, we have a president that doesn't really understand history. And I don't think we should knock him about that. What we really need to do is engage with the president, just like the, you know, like some of the other people are doing with the media. Engage with them. Don't argue, but engage, so that we can fully understand. Because the United States, the things that have happened in this country, we really can't look at any other part of the world and say that we are the bastion of freedom.
Right.
Because
thank
you. We've caused so many wars, and we need to change that.
Right. We tend to be a bellicose nation. So, I mean, Daoud, essentially, Kai, is saying what you've said, which is, you know, this is a historical problem, but we all have to bring ourselves up to educating ourselves and the president as well.
Yeah, I mean, he's referring to talking to the president. I wonder about, I mean, you know, I'm not sure there's much left to say with the president, but I wonder about the conversations that are happening in families now. Mm-hmm. You know,
with the rogue uncle that everyone
with the rogue uncle or brother or father or sister, mm-hmm. or you know, what are the conversations that we are having in our families now? Again, of all races, about history and our own personal roles, our family history and its relationship to race and racism, and because I think part of families are the place where this history is passed on.
Maybe not.
Yeah, you're still here now. Sorry.
Okay, the question I wanted is...
Oh, I think we
lost. Let's not forget about the natives. The natives who were here. There was a society here. Actually, the Constitution of the United States was patterned a lot after the native constitutions.
Okay, you know what, Daoud? That actually, you know what? That is fantastic, because that leads us actually into Mike from Manhattan, who actually had something to say about natives in this country. Mike, welcome to WNYC.
Hi, thank you. I've been leading a one-man campaign against the statue in front of the Museum of Natural History because it's xenophobic and racist.
You're referring to the statue of Teddy Roosevelt on a horse flanked by an enslaved African and a Native American?
Yeah, and he's pointing the way to them because obviously they don't know how to get around the country without his guidance.
Mm-hmm.
I've done petitions. I've actually... I write them every year, and they tell me that it's they keep it because same thing the Southerners use with the Confederate statues. It's their heritage and historic, but it's offensive.
Right. Well, thank you, Mike. So Kai, Mike from Manhattan finds it offensive, and you know it's the Museum of Natural History. They do get city funding and government funding. Let me just quickly remind callers, I'm Christina Greer, filling in for Brian Lehrer. I'm talking to Kai Riott of WNYC. We're taking your calls about problematic icons, statues, and signage here in your community. Maybe you always knew it was a problem. Maybe you're seeing it for the first time with fresh eyes after the protests in Charlottesville or another event. Our number here is 212-433-WNYC. That's 212-433-9692. Do you have any response to what Mike said from Manhattan about the statue in front of the Museum of Natural History?
Yeah, you know, I mean, and it's funny, the things we just don't see, right? Mm-hmm. You know, the things around us that are statements. I actually am still thinking about the Christopher Columbus statue in Columbus.
That serves as a beacon overlooking Central Park and, you know, sort of the entire West Side, if you
and
will.
And all that he represents. Mm-hmm. And I take it for granted, to be honest. I walk by that statue, I don't think about, oh, you know, what is it that it states? And so I think that's another great thing that is happening from this conversation, is that people all over the country are being forced to say, oh, wait, what are we memorializing, and what does this history, what does it mean to me? I think the other side of it is, I think about, you know, I've spent most of my adult life living in Black neighborhoods.
Mm-hmm.
And particularly here in New York, in Black neighborhoods, we have a wonderful array of representations, positive representations of Black people in the public square. We have murals of, mm-hmm. I lived in Bed-Stuy for 12, 13 years. And I always think about, there's a mural of judges, of Black judges in Brooklyn. I don't know who those people are, but right. Every day I walk by, you would look at these murals of Black judges, you know.
I wonder if former Comptroller Bill Thompson's father is on that mural.
For instance, you know, and so there, you know, and the fact that we have, you know, there's a Martin Luther King Jr. Avenue and a mm-hmm. Malcolm X Boulevard and just about every Black neighborhood in the country. And I think we take those things for granted, but they're so important.
Mm-hmm.
They're so important. And so the idea of, you know, I think we need to talk about what we need to take down, but also what we need to put up.
Well, I think, you know, that brings a really great point, because sometimes it's also about the monuments that aren't there, right? And the monuments that are missing. So, you know, Kai, I think about this all the time when I walk past the New York Stock Exchange. And when you're walking there in Wall Street, you see this beautiful open area, loads of tourists. And that's where enslaved people used to be sold, right? And these were the first commodity, you know, these people were the first commodity sold on the New York Stock Exchange. So we don't necessarily memorialize everyone and everything. So does not memorializing certain incidents and individuals speak as loudly and as problematic as the monuments we actually do put up?
Absolutely, and perhaps even louder. I think about, I often visit Charleston, South Carolina, and it's this town that is seeped in history of the slave trade, right? It exists entirely because of the domestic slave trade. That's what built Charleston. And they've got this beautiful historic quarter where tourists from all over the world come and they eat Southern food and they ride around on horse-drawn buggies and they look at the beautiful architecture and they talk about the Spanish-American War. and you could go, you could spend days in Charleston and not realize that you're sitting at the capital of the domestic slave trade. And that is an active rewriting of history. That is a way to turn this into something different. It's the same idea as in Wall Street. And so that's why I think it is. Or how many monuments exist to women, period, in New York City? Mm-hmm. How many monuments exist to women who have done important things in our history? Starts to tell a story about who is and is not important in terms of building our society. And so I have always been part, one of the reasons that I do live in black neighborhoods is that I enjoy that we are able to put up reminders of our own history in those neighborhoods, and that's great. But we have to start figuring out how to put up those monuments elsewhere around the country. We had a wonderful conversation on the show, on Brian Lehrer's show yesterday, with Brian Stevenson, who's working on the set of lynching memorials around the country. For instance, we absolutely have to erect these things to tell us about our history.
Right. I mean, I always think about that when I go to the fairway on 132nd Street and 12th Avenue in Harlem, you know, right before you get on the highway. And, you know, that's a site of an African burial ground, but the community lost out and wasn't able to prevent the bus depot from being built there. Right. So we have this beautiful national park and African burial ground near City Hall, but unfortunately not in Harlem to memorialize the citizens that were the civilians who actually lived there and worked in that neighborhood. We're going to go with Miles from Harlem. Miles, welcome to WNYC.
Good morning. Thank you for taking my call. And so we are speaking about statue. There is one at the corner of 79th Street and Central Park. That was a man named J. Marion Sims.
Indeed, Dr. James Marion Sims, yeah.
Yeah, J. Marion Sims. He was the one who used the wall. He is credited as being the father of gynecology in this country. He's the one who used to work on the enslaved African women for their master so that they can be able to service him. And he did that without anesthesia. He used very crude instruments on them. And when he was finished with them, he repaired them, he brought them back to their masters. If we want to take down statue, then that's another statue we need to look at too and see the role he played in history. Personally, it offends me, but I'm a foreigner. I live here, so I can't put some of those things on my face. But I do know the history because I managed to go to school here, and then I know some of this stuff. But it actually offends me. The statue is there. His name is J. Marion Sims. So maybe some of you can pick it up, or some of you in the public eye or have an audience can pick it up, or at least bring it to the attention of New Yorkers.
Yes, thank you, Miles. I know some historians are actually working on a committee to really address that issue, just because it was a relatively common practice that individuals who owned other individuals to experiment on them in various capacities. And so I do know that there are a committee of historians who are really looking at that. So let's go to Pamela in Queens. Pamela, welcome to WNYC.
Hello. Thank you for taking my call. I think another aspect of this statuary issue is labeling. Some years ago, there was a wonderful show at the Metropolitan Museum of Art on the work of Augustus St. Gaudens, who's done a lot of civic sculpture in this country and notably in New York. And, of course, at the southernmost tip of Central Park, there is the statue of Sherman, General Sherman, marching southward, as it were, in victory. And accompanying him is the figure of Victory, holding aloft a laurel leaf. It's not known that the model, the real-life model for that sculpture, for that figure of Victory, was an African-American woman that Augustus St. Gaudens had used a lot in a lot of his civic sculpture work. And I was very surprised to have learned that when I went to the Met show. But there's no acknowledgement of that at all at that statue. There's no label. We know that Sherman is the figure on the horse, mm-hmm. but the figure of Victory was a real person and was a woman of African-American descent. She was considered an African-American woman, even though she presented as European.
Right.
And
wow.
I think that those sorts of bits of information also need to be included. We have lots of tourists. We have a lot of people mm-hmm. in this city who don't know that kind of information. And I think that that also needs to be acknowledged.
Thank you so much, Pamela. Linda from Staten Island, really briefly, what have you discovered?
I'm a native Staten Islander. I'm white, and I've always been interested in our history from when I was little. And there is a town called Rosebank, and there's a small brass sign on a traffic triangle with a couple of flowers and a flagpole. And it burns me up every time I see it because it says, "This garden maintained by the Rosebank Boys." And the Rosebank Boys, going back to the 50s, 60s, even into the 70s, were really a perennial group of thugs, white thugs, that would walk around with bats, and if any blacks walked through the neighborhood, they would chase them out. Only recently has Rosebank, evolved to a much more Filipino and Mexican neighborhood, but like white people who didn't pay attention back then don't know what they're reading and what they're living among.
Mm-hmm.
And I got to say, I thank you for this program of rational conversation. And if I could just say one thing that I've learned over my 50 years of listening is to, when you speak to people and they talk, believe them. Believe what they're telling you about their experience living in this country. I do happen to have black friends, and
right.
the only reason I have black friends is because that we've maintained our friendship. They've let me share what it is to be in my life,
right.
and they share with me what it is to be black in America.
Thank you so much, Linda. I mean, I think that, that's Kai, as we briefly finish up. I mean, do you have any thoughts on what Linda's shared or... any of our other previous callers?
I just think that, the takeaway here is that history matters, right? Mm-hmm. We know that history matters. It shapes our understanding of today's politics and today's policy debates. And this iconography that we've built around us is a part of how we carry that history. And so it's deeply important. And as shocking as the president's remarks are, I welcome the fact that they've caused us to have this conversation.
Well, we'll have to leave it there for today. My great thanks to Kai Wright, who's the editor and host of the United States of Anxiety podcast from WNYC. Thanks, Kai.
Thank you.